Good afternoon, judges. Excuse me a minute, please, the court. My name is Gregory Williams. I'm with the firm Marcus Williams, Young & Zimmerman. I represent the appellants in this matter. Counsel? I would like to try to reserve 3 minutes of my time for rebuttal, if that's possible. I'll try to keep track of the timing here, and I'll try not to repeat what's been said in the briefs. This case has important implications beyond just the facts of this case, but the facts of this case are relatively simple. Mr. Byerly was contracted to provide development management services for a subdivision in Larimer County. He signed a contract in October of 2006. The contract provided that he would do 8 specified things and that he was to be compensated in 2 ways. Number 1, a monthly salary of $7,000 a month. And number 2, a bonus or an incentive as these phases of the subdivision were completed and sold of what was called lot compensation. He could either select 2.5 lots or he could receive the cash value of those 2.5 lots. Mr. Byerly started performing his work. My client provided the construction financing. The recession hit us, and a number of other factors, both within and without Mr. Byerly's control as development manager, eventually overtook this development. In August of 2009, almost 3 years after Mr. Byerly had signed his contract, and after 3 years of performance, it became clear to my client that further funding was simply not going to complete this project. The loans had matured, the loans were called, and at that point, construction ceased. Mr. Byerly continued to work after August of 2009, although he was not paid his $7,000 a month salary. Mr. Byerly later claimed a mechanics lien in which he sought not only his $7,000 per month back pay that he had not been paid, but also a significant, very significant number for the lot compensation portion of his contract. He amended his lien. He reduced the lot compensation portion of his contract to approximately $500,000. And he increased his salary claim for the time that he had worked since he filed his original mechanics lien. The property was taken back in foreclosure. Mr. Byerly's mechanics lien came on for trial in Larimer County. And unfortunately, the fundamental flaw and error that occurred in this case occurred when the trial judge in Larimer County determined that simply because Mr. Byerly and his employer, and or his employer, had failed to file his 2006 development management contract of record, then Mr. Byerly was no longer limited by that contract to the terms of the compensation to which he had agreed. The Larimer County District Court, after 2 days of evidence, then determined that Mr. Byerly was entitled not just to the $7,000 per month that he had contracted for, but to an objective market value of $12,000 per month. And the trial court then entered a judgment for Mr. Byerly on his lien claim for approximately $350,000, carrying that $12,000 per month all the way back to the inception of his contract in October of 2006. Even though Mr. Byerly had been paid monthly from October 2006 through August of 2009.
Mr. Williams, I hate to interrupt, but I'm pretty familiar with the facts. And so I'd like to ask you a bit about the statutes.
Please.
Please, I'd like you to look at section 3822.101.2, subsection 2, and that says that in a case of a contract for the work, the lien shall extend to the entire contract price. Now, does that language inform the outcome of this case here?
Yes.
How does it?
The contract price was $7,000 per month.
All right. And is it your understanding that that statutory language means that the contract price is a cap on the amount that can be liened?
As between the two parties to the contract, yes.
Not as the subcontractors, I understand.
Correct.
Okay.
We're not dealing with subcontractors here. We're dealing with two parties, Mr. Byerly and the owner, who have a direct contract, one with the other, for these services. There are no subcontractors involved in this case.
So in a mechanics lien situation where additional work is done above and beyond the contract price, does that matter, or is the lien still capped at the contract price?
The lien is capped at the contract price as between the contracting parties. And I think, as we all know in the real world, contracting parties often and frequently go beyond the terms of the written contract when they perform services. But the contract is the contract.
So if there's no change order, for example, that is an amendment to the contract, the cap still is the contract price as to the amount that can be liened, as between those two parties?
Correct. Correct. And that's the issue that we're here on today, and that's the issue that the trial court, with all due respect, was thoroughly confused on. The trial court determined that since the contract wasn't recorded between these two parties, that the parties weren't bound by their contract under section 3822.101.3. And thereafter took evidence on what the court thought would be a reasonable value for the services that Mr. Byerly performed without reference to the contract.
Counsel, you indicated that there are no subcontractors involved in this case.
None.
So redirecting your attention to 3822.101.2, then when it talks about all persons performing labor or services, there really isn't an issue in this case that applies to the parties in this
case. That's correct.
That seems to be the basis of Appley's argument and the holding of the trial court, is that all persons would also include a party directly contracting, such as Byerly.
It is. And that leads to what, again, with all due respect, I believe is an absurd result. We have two judgments in this case, one for $350,000 on Mr. Byerly's lien claim against the property, and one for $146,000 against the owner on breach of contract for the very same services. Difference being, in the trial court's judgment, the contract wasn't recorded. That's the difference.
And what do we do with the words all persons?
I'm sorry.
What's the antecedent for all persons that would lead us to conclude that it would not include a party that's directly contracting with the owner?
That's the statutory harmonization, Your Honor, that I think you have to perform in this case. You need to read 3822.101, sub 1, which is the general grant of a mechanics lien right to persons who provide labor and services. Sub 2 is the general or direct contractor provision, which governs what happens when there is a principal contractor with a written contract and subcontractors who perform services pursuant to their agreement with the general contractor. And then you have sub 3, which is totally a subcontractor provision. Sub 3 indicates, you can read it as well as I can, that subcontractors are put in the position of a direct contractor if the direct contract is not recorded. We don't have that here. We have a direct contract, two parties. Subsection 2 is the one that applies. And when you harmonize 2 with 3, and I'll paraphrase 3, in fact, I'll read 3. In case such contract, and that's the written direct contract, is not so filed, the labor done and materials furnished by all persons shall be deemed to have been done and furnished at the personal instance of the owner. That makes no sense when you have direct contracting parties. They are already in privity with one another. This references subcontractors who are not in privity with the owner, only with the general contractor. Excuse me, and it provides that the subcontractors may then prove the value of their work to support their lien. We have no quarrel with that, but that's not what we have here, and that's what the trial court fatally misinterpreted when it simply disregarded the direct contract between these two parties and focused solely on subsection 3, determined that because that contract wasn't recorded, the contract need not be observed, and took evidence on what the reasonable value from an objective standpoint would be. And that's how we get to $12,000 a month for the lien and $7,000 a month for the judgment on the direct contract for the same services.
And counsel, you have 3 minutes left.
We have the excessive lien claim too. I will spend just a moment or two on that. Mr. Byerly knew more than anyone else about how his contract worked because he had negotiated it himself. He knew he was not due hundreds of thousands of dollars of lot compensation when he filed the lien. He knew he was not due hundreds of thousands of dollars of lot compensation when he amended his lien, and he did the amendment with advice of counsel, not solely in a vacuum and not as a lay person. I will describe for you in my rebuttal exactly what he knew and when he knew it, but this is a very clear case of a person attempting to leverage a lien claim, knowing that he was not entitled to the amounts claimed. And it falls within the same parameters of LSV and waiver. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. You have 2 minutes left.
Good afternoon. My name is Zachary Wilson, attorney registration 12608, appearing today on behalf of the appellee, David Daniel Byerly. The appellant, Bank of Colorado, and its affiliate, Delta Properties 2, request that this court overrule the trial court's well-reasoned and well-articulated decision. To do so, this court would have to adopt the appellant's argument, adopting a constrained and limited view of the mechanics lien statute when traditionally it has been liberally viewed. This court would also have to, in its opinion, discuss and interpret the words all, such, and do, as Mr. Williams has expressed in his briefs filed in this matter. Or the court can accept the plain meaning of the statute, accept the trial court's plain reading of the statute, and rely on the trial court's assessment of the demeanor and the credibility of the witnesses. Under CRS 3822-101-1, every person who furnishes labor and machinery or tools, and all persons of every class performing labor, shall have a lien upon the property. The trial court specifically found that Byerly took all necessary steps to perfect his lien as required by the statute. The trial court specifically found that Byerly performed labor on the Wild Wing project and was entitled to a lien for his long hours and physical labor. Further, the trial court found that all of his labor was lienable, citing the Manguso case. The trial court also noted that Bank of Colorado never argued or asserted non-lienable labor at trial. The broad protections afforded by afforded laborers and materialmen under Section 101 are offset by the protections to for property owners set forth in subsections 2 and 3, where there is a contract for services and materials of over $500. The owner can protect himself by merely filing a copy of that contract or a memorandum of that contract in the county clerk and recorder's office.
Isn't the purpose of that filing so that third parties will be on notice as to the contractual cap in place? And in the kind of situation we have here, doesn't Mr. Byerly, as a directly contracting party, already have full notice of what that contractual limit is?
There is a notice aspect to for third parties, but the way that provision has been interpreted, it also provides a cap against Byerly. So if the owner wants to protect against additional charges from Mr. Byerly, the recording of that would act as that cap.
Well, let's talk about subsection 2, the first couple of words, as I did with your learned colleague. It says, in case of a contract for the work, the lien shall extend to the entire contract price. Why doesn't that put a cap on the amount of the lien at the contract price?
It does if it is recorded.
But no, this is not in the recording section. The recording section is subsection 3.
Okay.
This is subsection 2.
In the case of the contract, the lien would provide a contract, would be limited to the contract price. But the contract price was not merely the $7,000 per month. The testimony at trial was that that was a sub, a reduced, diminished value because the developer didn't have the funds to pay what the value of Byerly's monthly services were.
So you're saying the contract price was not the contract price?
I'm saying the contract price included the lot compensation.
Right, if it was due.
If the lot compensation was due, but the developer breached the development management agreement. And therefore, Byerly was entitled to seek the protections afforded by the mechanics lien statute.
Well, what I'm trying to discern, counsel, is as I read subsection 1, it says that the contract price is the cap for the lien.
Yes.
Which is not what the trial court held. The trial court held the contract price. The contract price is inapplicable because the contract was not recorded. I'm having a little bit of difficulty understanding how the trial court got to that, given this language in subsection 2. Can you help me with that?
I believe the trial court looked at subsection 3 and tried to take subsections 1, 2, and 3 and read them all together. And in doing so, you know, the provision of 3 allows Mr. Byerly allows him to claim the full value of his services.
Well, I can see why that would make sense for a subcontractor who doesn't have a direct contract with the landowner. I don't understand any policy reason why the legislature would have made that applicable to a direct contractor who has a direct contract with the landowner. Can you help me with that?
Well, again, the direct contract provided two sections for compensation that comprised the entirety of the compensation that was due to Byerly. So it's not merely the $7,000 per month.
Well, let's talk about the word due, which you've
Correct.
Been using. The statute says, uses the term then due. You can file a lien, the excessive lien statute says you can file a lien for the amount that is then due.
Correct.
Now, as I read your client's testimony at trial, he conceded that the lot compensation was not due to him on the day that he filed the lien. So it wasn't then due, was it?
The testimony of Mr. Byerly also included the fact that the letter from Mr. Vogel of February 11th indicated that he had earned his lot compensation.
Right, but there was the earning of it.
Right.
And then the requirement of the landowner to pay it.
Pay.
Those were two separate requirements, right?
Yes.
All right. So the concept that it was due had been met, right?
Yes.
But the conditions preceding to the landowner's requirement to pay it had not been met. He had admitted that in his testimony, correct?
Well, that was only after the court ruled on summary judgment and the...
Well, his testimony is his testimony, right?
His testimony is, but his testimony took into account that he had already read the summary judgment order saying it wasn't due. But at the time he filed it, he thought it was due.
Where is the testimony that says he thought it was due on the date that he filed the lien? Is there any testimony in the record that he thought it was due on the date he filed the lien?
There was no testimony on the record that he thought it was due on the date because it had already been resolved. We didn't cover that at trial. It had already been resolved in the summary judgment order. So the focus of the trial was on the value of his services under the mechanics lien statute, not under the contract.
Is there any testimony in the record anywhere that he thought he was due lot compensation on the date he filed the lien?
I believe there was in depositions that he can't track.
But that's not in the trial court record.
I don't believe it is, Your Honor.
We're limited to what's in the record, aren't we?
I understand you're limited to what's in the record, but based upon the court's own analysis of the contract in the summary judgment and looking at the evidence that was presented at trial, and in her analysis of the excessive lien statute in that provision of her ruling, she perceived that Mr. Byerly was justified based upon his knowledge of the contract and the amount that was due for a lot of compensation.
Now, we're familiar with how difficult mechanics lien cases can be, and that we know that if a mechanics lien or overleans, that liener loses the lien. We know that, right?
Yes.
So people are very, very careful about how they file these liens, and in fact, there's the excessive lien statute that says you lose your lien if certain requirements are.
Yes.
Now, if your interpretation were to be adopted and the trial court's interpretation were to stand, couldn't a mechanics liener, in any case where the contract isn't filed of record with the clerk and recorder, couldn't any mechanics liener just say, well, it wasn't filed, so my feeling is that the value of my services were the contract price plus a couple hundred thousand dollars. Why isn't that always the case? Why can't you always do that and avoid the excessive lien statute?
Well, I don't think that lien claim would win at trial if he just says, I feel that I am entitled to additional compensation when he had a direct contract with the owner that was fully performed. In this case, there was a breach by the developer which disallowed Mr. Byerly from receiving his lot compensation. Therefore, he says, I'm not going to recover the amount.
Are you saying he didn't get lot compensation because it was a breach, or he didn't get lot compensation because there was no duty to pay it?
He didn't get lot compensation because I believe the developer breached its contract, wasn't able to perform fully the completion of the subdivision.
But the duty to pay had not arisen.
Yes, the conditions preceding, meaning repayment of the loan and unencumbered lots that could be delivered to Mr. Byerly, didn't occur.
And counsel, weren't those risks that your client was taking that the conditions preceding would not be met?
Yes.
You may continue.
All right. In this case, the court made a specific finding that the owner, Wildwing, had not recorded Byerly's contract. And based upon the full reading of subsections 1, 2, and 3, determined that Ireland was entitled to the value of the contract. And that's the basis for the court's order. The trial court reviewed the evidence and the testimony, and utilizing a plain reading of the text, without extensive discussions as to the definitions of these, what I thought were simple words, but perhaps they're not, and determined that he was entitled to that value. The court did not err in its ruling that Byerly could recover more compensation for the value for his services than he could recover under the contract. Bank of Colorado argues that the trial court ignored the development management agreement when it did not. It analyzed it in detail. Byerly's contract claim was only one of five claims for relief. When he received the summary judgment ruling saying he could not recover under the contract, he shifted his attention to the mechanics lien aspect of the case. Bank of Colorado argues that it is an innocent party that had no duty to record the development management agreement. That is not true. The development management agreement was turned over as a part of the due diligence loan process. The Bank of Colorado contends that this would cause chaos in the construction lending industry and would kill the construction lending practice. That is not true. All the lender would have to do to provide the cap on the amount that could be claimed by contractors would be to record memorandums of the various contracts with the subcontractors. So, the trial court did not err in measuring the value of Byerly services as being the base compensation set forth in the DMA. Rather, the court heard the evidence of the standard salary for project managers of a project of this size, and based upon the evidence, determined that $12,000 was more of a reasonable compensation or a fair compensation, as was negotiated between Mr. Bogle and Mr. Byerly. Mr. Bogle testified that Byerly was seeking $13,000 or $14,000 per month and asked Mr. Byerly what he could live on. And that's how the $7,000 base salary was determined. So based upon that and the testimony of Mr. Snyder and Mr. Tissot, the court determined that a more fair salary was, and the value of his services would be $12,000. The trial court did not err in awarding Byerly additional compensation for the 3 years because his work was worth $12,000 from the time he started in March 2006. Did not err in awarding Byerly an amount reflecting an average project manager's salary. That was the evidence that was presented at trial. And the court looked at the credibility of the witnesses and determined that it was a fair salary. The fifth issue, the trial court did not err in reducing the value of Byerly's services by his purported financial damages inflicted. He did not inflict damages, and at the time he filed the lien, he thought that it was not excessive. He did not knowingly file a bad lien. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
Judge Terry, thank you for your question. I think you hit it right on the head here. The issue in this case is, because this direct contract wasn't recorded, does that allow one party to sidestep the contract altogether and, in effect, seek greater value for services than the contract provided? That's what happened here, and I think that's where the trial court got totally confused with the interplay between 101 section subsection 2 and 101 subsection 3. I don't think the trial court fully appreciated the interplay between the two. I think the trial court simply looked at the fact that the contract wasn't recorded, looked at subsection 3, said, okay, it's not recorded. That means I can take evidence of the objective value of the services irrespective of the contract. That's what happened. That's why we have three times the judgment for the lien against the judgment on the contract against the owners itself. And that's the crux of this case. In a direct contracting party situation, subsection 3 does not apply. Subsection 2 does.
Now, I don't think this court is going to find a much clearer circumstance for excessive lien than this case presents. I want to talk just a moment about that. When Mr. Byerly filed his original lien in 2006, he knew, and this is all in the record, Bank of Colorado had ceased funding a year earlier. He knew that there were no other sources of construction funding. He knew that no construction activity had taken place since August of 2009. He knew that a suit had been filed by the bank against the borrower and the guarantors on these two development loans. He knew that foreclosure was pending in Larimer County Public Trustee's office and that the property would go to sale on March the 24th. He filed his lien on March 15th, about 10 days earlier than the sale. He knew that bankruptcy was planned because he had come to Denver to meet with the Wild Wing Bankruptcy Council to work over the creditor's matrix because he was the one who knew the most about the property and he was the one who knew the most about who was owed what.
Counselor, your time has expired.
Thank you, Your Honor. I would close with one last comment. This is an important case for the construction industry because if we're allowed to avoid contracts simply because they're not.
Counsel, important. I'm sorry, your time has expired.
Thank you.
Thank you both for your arguments. A case will stand submitted and an opinion will issue in due course. And